It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And Adam is back in studio. We are here as usual, alert mostly after this week. Maybe not 100%.
Yeah.
It was brutal out there. But we'll get back to that. Anyway, all the regulars, thanks for always being there. You know, we depend on you. And as long as you're there, we'll be here. That's just the way this thing works. If you're new to the show, if you found out by talking to somebody or just by accident or whatever it is, try to stick around for the hour. We always promise that you'll learn something in the course of an hour. And remember that if you want to talk about anything that's on your mind, all you got to do is pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255. And we'll talk about what you want to talk about on air. So don't ever be afraid of us. We don't bite. And if we don't have an answer, we'll always have it for you by next week. If you are shy and don't want to talk on air, then just send us an email, info@vanweefinancial.com, and we'll either get it during the show and answer it, or we'll have it for you next week for sure. So it's easy to do. As I said, there wasn't much fun going on this week, but I did want to do a little follow-up on last week. Those of you who were with us last week remember that Craig Kaprosky was with us. He's with Goosehead Insurance. They're an all-line insurance company for property and casualty. And we wanted to talk with him because of what's going on in the insurance market. And it's what's going on in Florida right now has gotten to the point of ridiculous because we're starting to price people out of the home market. And that is the last thing anybody wants, to not be able to afford a home in Florida. So the legislature is working on some things, and there's some other things they're only talking about, not really working on. But one thing that did come out of this that everybody should recognize, if you're paying attention, we didn't really talk specifically about it, but it was mentioned in passing. And that is, if you're one of the people in Florida that has your annual renewal for your homeowner's insurance in hurricane season, meaning June 1 through November 30th, make it a point to shop your insurance after hurricane season is over. In fact, I'd go so far as to say, if you want a great New Year's resolution, if you are a renewal that falls between June and November, and you want to shop for a better rate, you will do a lot better shopping in January than you will right now, because insurers are very reluctant to do anything this time of year because they're always running scared during hurricane season. So that bit of wisdom from Craig should help anybody out there who's looking at that. And of course, all this came about because both of us sitting in this room had horrible results with our annual renewals falling at the wrong time this year. And we got hold of Craig, and he has largely fixed the problem, not without some hassles, of course, but what do you expect? But he put a lot of money back in our pockets that the insurance companies were willing to take out in the form of massive increases. So if you're stuck by that, I always recommend an independent agent. I know there's a lot of loyalty. In fact, we talked about this last week. There's a lot of people with intense loyalties to the big boys like State Farm and Allstate and those. And I'm telling you, folks, in rarely do we ever hear a story in our practice about people getting rewarded for their loyalty from these people. The more likely scenario is you pay them and pay them and pay them years after year after year, and maybe even too much, and then they drop you because of some thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I've had it happen. Adam's had it happen.
Mm-hmm. Or they just raise your rate to a point where it's no longer competitive, yep. And that's effectively being dropped as
well. Yeah, it's their point of indifference, as I call it. In other words, they're going to charge so much. Oh, okay, we'll keep you as long as you're willing to do that. Like a 58% increase on top of last year's increase.
Yeah, which is basically what I got this year.
Yeah.
And so I switched, and Craig helped me do that. So definitely give him a call if you are feeling a little bit like you're getting robbed by your insurance company.
Yep. And if you need some help finding Craig, you can call the office and we'll be happy to put you in there. He has been very helpful. Also helped one of my daughters this year. So, you know, the guy gets on it and something will happen, but again, his recommendation, wait till after hurricane season until things settle down and then try to shop. You'll have a lot more choices. Because what's happened here, 11 insurers left Florida altogether in the last few years. There are now 8 approved to come back, and they will be getting back into business as time goes on this year and early next. That's going to improve the competitive nature of homeowners insurance by quite a bit, I would imagine. So you don't think all is lost. It is not yet. It's just postponed a little bit.
Yeah, and a couple of things on that too. One, there are more options now. I haven't heard of actually anyone having to go with Citizens recently. That doesn't mean it isn't happening, but all the quotes I've seen recently have been lower than existing policies, and they've been with private carriers and not with Citizens. So that's good news. The other good news is just be happy you live in Florida, because the legislature is trying to do something about it, and successfully, I would say, at least the start. In California, they're going the other way. They're making it more restrictive for insurance companies to do business there, and they have the exact same problem we have right now. It's their California insurance, the equivalent of Citizens, is growing like crazy, and private insurers are leaving the state. So sometimes it's good to live in Florida.
Yeah, California by law says you have to have reserves to cover all of your potential losses. So if you had the worst year that your portfolio of policies could have, then you would have to have enough reserves, including reinsurance, to cover them all. They have, I don't know the exact number, I reported it last week, but they have something to the tune of 1% or 2% of their reserves covered. You do not want to do business with the California version of Citizens. And jumping back to the East Coast, Citizens doesn't really want to do business with you.
No, they don't. They were never meant to do business.
No.
It was supposed to be the last resort. It just, everything got so bad that it became the only resort for too many people.
Yeah. So all that said, thanks again to Craig, and I hope everybody took a little something away from that you can eventually put in the bank. All right, I suppose we have to talk about it.
Well, we only left ourselves about a minute.
Yeah, so. Unfortunately, we got to come back after the break.
You know, it was kind of like September just wanted to announce that it was here and live up to its own bad reputation. It is the worst month in the market historically, and man, did that prove true this week. It was just brutal. Tuesday in particular was awful after the long weekend, and it didn't get much better from there. Wednesday and Thursday weren't too bad. Friday was pretty awful, and Friday actually started on a positive note and then turned around. So, but it wasn't just us, as I'll get into. It was everywhere. Everything sold off except for bonds. That was the only thing people were buying.
Yep. It's almost indescribable when the herd mentality takes over.
Yeah.
Watching everything just get sold arbitrarily. And it's at times like that that you as individuals and us as small practitioners in the big scheme of things understand just how insignificant we are. We cannot cause the market to change. You have to play ball with what you've got. And lots more on that coming up right after this short break. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we do, as usual, have a trivia question brought to you by, in this case, brought to you by Paul Lloyd at First Coast Alarm. After 10 years of saying it the other way, it's really hard.
It makes it tough.
Anyway, you can call Paul at 904-636-7888. Back in 2006, and let me set the table just a little bit more, everybody who follows precious metals probably is aware that they've kind of been on a tear here recently. And there's many reasons for that, many theories for that. And for whatever reason, they're supposedly supposed to be storehouses of safe money for times like this, supposed to be inflation hedges and all that. But regardless, back in 2006, they invented a way for the average person to buy gold and silver without having to buy physical gold and silver and find a place to store it and all that, by using an exchange-traded fund or ETF. So back then was born SLV, that was backed up by real silver, but it's sold in electronic form on an exchange. And similarly, GLD for gold, doing the same thing. If you had put $10,000 in each of those, A, you'd be pretty happy today. But two, here's the one that really matters. One has outperformed the other. I want to know which one and by how much since that day.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah. All right, back to the rotten week that was. We'll get into more of the market and jobs and all that stuff.
But yep, it was really painful. But the like I said, we weren't alone. It was mostly driven by negative sentiment around the economy. And the fear, I think, is that we are slipping into a recession. Last week, all was good. We were headed for a soft landing. This week, everyone thinks that we're going to fall off a cliff and hit a deep recession.
Yeah, an irony of ironies. This is the week that the yield curve uninverted.
Yeah,
also true. It would be one of those what next moments if that happened.
So I checked this morning, and given the negative sentiment this week, I expected to see a 50 basis point rate cut be the likely scenario for the Fed, but the market's only pricing in a 30% chance of that, and a quarter point is at 70%. So odds are still on just a quarter point drop on the 17th, I think, is when the meeting is. So sometime around.
Yeah, like then. That. Mm-hmm. 17, 18, I think.
Yeah. The one thing that we are looking at is that the jobs data right now clearly shows a deteriorating market. Like the jobs are, and if you anecdotally, it's probably worse than the data would suggest.
Yeah, it'd be a lot more clear if they wouldn't obfuscate.
It's clear at this point that jobs are much harder to come by than they were a year or two ago, and they're getting harder and harder to come by with each passing month. So I don't think inflation is the primary concern of the Fed anymore. I think it's actually the job situation or the economy. Mm-hmm. So despite the terrible week in the market, the quarter hasn't been completely negative yet. The Dow is holding on to a 3.1% gain. However, the S&P is down 1% and the NASDAQ is off almost 6%. So it hasn't been a great quarter so far. For the year, all three indexes are still up nicely, though, with the Dow up 7%, the S&P up 13.4%, and the NASDAQ up 11.2%. Stocks weren't the only thing falling this week. Commodities were also hit pretty hard. They were led lower by the price of oil, which saw a pretty dramatic decline of 7.3%.
It's 67.67. I checked before I left the house, and that hasn't been seen for a while.
No, not at all. Again, concerns there are for a global recession. Gold has a slim loss of this week of 0.3%, while silver was down 3.3%. The overall commodities market got hit to the tune of 4%. International markets, as I mentioned, not much better than domestic markets. The all world except U.S. ETF fell 3.6%. Asian markets were down more than the U.S. markets in some cases, with the 50 largest Asian companies falling a combined 5.8%. China did a little bit better than average, falling just 2.7. Sometimes you win by losing less. European markets were also down, losing 3.6%. South American companies fared a little bit better than average, losing just 2.6%. There was not a single market that I could find internationally that was up this week. That doesn't mean there wasn't one. I just couldn't find it. The only winner I did locate was the bond market. It posted a gain of 1.3%. The bond market is quietly having a good year at this point. It's up now 4.5% on the aggregate market. Year to date, all of those gains have come since May. This quarter, the ETF AGG is up 5.2%. And since May, it's up almost 8%. Long treasuries have rallied almost 15% since May. And year to date, they're only up 3.3%, though. So the latter half of this year has really been where all the strength is in the bond market. And of course, that's due to the anticipation of rate cuts. This week, all the economic data was about jobs. Wednesday saw the ADP released. It showed just 99,000 new jobs created. That was the fifth straight month of declines in that report. The JOLTS report then showed a 5% larger than expected drop in job openings, with a 3% revision downward to June data. Job openings are now down to 7.7 million, which is just about in line with the pre-COVID peak. However, if you look at the trend, it is really sharply down, and it has been for quite some time, as is the quit rate. And at the same time, layoffs and discharges are trending up. So none of the data is going the right way. On Friday, we got the report that everyone wanted to see, which was the employment situation report, aka the jobs report. It came in a little bit weaker than expected on the headline. The target was 165,000 new jobs, but the actual results were 142. Not a huge miss. And then the market actually rallied on those numbers on Friday morning. The futures shot up and the market opened and we saw green on the screen. But by midday, it was pretty ugly. That sentiment had shifted and it was going to be an ugly day. The unemployment rate actually dropped from 4.3 to 4.2%. In addition, the two areas that are known to spike in recession are prime age, which is 25 to 54, unemployment rate and private worker earnings. And oddly, both of those are actually holding up quite well. So go figure, not everything in this economy lines up like it should. So whatever you're expecting, you can find data to support it and whatever. But then someone can make a very valid counter argument on that same data. So it's, again, just a confusing time.
Yeah, the disconcerting thing for a lot of us is that throughout this administration, there have been over-reporting followed by negative reductions. And yesterday was no exception to that. So when the 142 came out, that was greeted with at least some enthusiasm along with the drop in the unemployment rate.
I think it was like that's not that bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sort of a relief. But then, all of a sudden, they announced that the prior 2 months were being adjusted downward, as is typical. 61,000 were removed from July, and another 25,000 were removed from June. So with that 86,000 gone, all of a sudden, you're in the very paltry range for a monthly job gain. And that part is even made worse when you subtract out government jobs. And that's made worse yet if you subtract out healthcare, which are largely government-supported jobs. Now you're negative. And don't forget that last month they arbitrarily or actually or whatever, I'm not sure how they would describe it, removed 818,000 jobs that they had previously created. So with about a $900,000 reduction, if you look even deeper, there are less Americans working now than there were when they came in.
Over the last year, jobs for native-born Americans are down 1.3 million, yep, and jobs for foreign-born workers are up 2 million.
Yep. And then dig a little bit deeper and look at the change in part-time jobs.
So part-time jobs are up 527,000, while full-time jobs have actually lost 438,000. Mm-hmm. So about a million split there.
So if you're a normal, regular old American, born here, raised here, go to work every day, all that, you have not fared well at all. Plus, you're just putting frosting on the cake. The problem is that real wages, meaning after inflation is subtracted out, have been steadily declining ever since the Trump administration. You put it all together, it's not a pretty sight. That means the Fed, basically the Fed admitted what's going to happen, but they just didn't give us the details. Yes, they have shifted their policy to lower interest rates, and that is definitely going to happen in September. I don't think there's a soul in the world who doesn't think it will. By how much, I don't know, but you can look at that any way you want to, too. From the Fed policy standpoint, if they all of a sudden go from not having done anything for a long time to dropping a half point, it's going to kind of signal that it's worse than we thought and we're behind the curve.
Yeah.
That's why I don't really expect it.
I don't either, and the market doesn't either. So I understand that sentiment. The other problem with the economic policy that's been in place for the last 4 years or 3.5 years or since COVID is that if you had a good management level job, owned a house, had assets, had a 401k, you probably still have all of those things today. And you're probably feeling pretty good about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is if you didn't have any of those things, you probably are unemployed, paying way more than you can afford for rent and can't ever afford to buy a house. And so the people on the lower end of the economic scale have been hit the hardest. And there really hasn't been any policy that has helped them out. Well, the people on the upper end have done really, really well. And that is not an economy that works for everyone.
No, and we're faced with some major changes coming up if the election goes one certain way, the tax rates that were reduced back in 2017, effective 2018, will be made permanent. And if it goes the other way, the old rates are coming back. And under that, every household is going to average about $2,400 in increased costs, and that is also not the way it's being sold to people. A little more when we come back. We'll be right here. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
A reminder that the trivia question is still out there. In 2006, the exchange-traded funds for gold and silver were created. Had you put $10,000 in each of them, you would have a nice little pile of money right now. But one of them outperformed the other. I want to know by how many dollars one outperformed the other and which one was on the good end of that. All right, we've probably beaten up the market pretty badly. But a lot of what's going on today is getting scary to me because there's so much misinformation out there. And that's another word that they have usurped. And how can you describe things when they've ruined the definition of so many words like fair share and so on? It means something new now, something that it never meant before. And misinformation is getting to the same way. But a lot of it, I find, is due to media ignorance or stupidity or both. And I've got a classic example. I'm going to play a little Stump the Band with Adam, and he doesn't know what I'm going to do here. So I'm just going to ask him out of the clear blue. If I were worried he'd get it wrong, I wouldn't ask. So, all right, what's better, a tax credit or a tax deduction?
Oh, tax credit.
And why is that?
Because you get the full amount of the value out of it.
Okay. One of the highlights of the recent proposal from the Harris group says they're going to raise the current tax break on small business from $5,000 to $50,000. I want to know, is that a tax credit or is that a tax deduction?
What's the $5,000?
It's a, I don't know if it's a deduction or a credit, but it's supposed to be for starting a small business.
Oh, okay.
I personally
I'm not familiar with it.
Was not familiar with it either because apparently it didn't exist when we started ours.
Okay.
But anyway, she wants to, she's playing the one-upsmanship game.
Yeah.
Me too, only more. So, curious me, looked it up. And here's what I found. The CBS Morning News says it's a tax credit.
I mean, that's a huge tax credit for small business. $50,000 is enormous.
Fast Company says it's a tax deduction. Bankrate.com, pretty credible. They say it's a tax credit. Forbes, also credible, says it's a tax deduction. MSN quoted the Wall Street Journal calling it a tax deduction. The New York Times called it a tax deduction. You can see where this is kind of leading. But then Axios came out later in the week and called it a tax credit. But the winner, you ready for this one? The winner of every news source I could put my fingers on was the Tax Foundation, who called it a refundable tax credit.
Okay.
Now, do you want to explain what a refundable tax credit is, or do you want me to?
I mean, go ahead. You got it.
A refundable tax credit is money they give you whether you made money or not.
Right. So it's the motherlode of all tax breaks.
It is. Now, they're out on the stump interchanging the term tax break with tax credit and tax deduction. If it's a deduction, your small company has to be profitable enough that that tax deduction would reduce its taxes. If it's a tax credit, in theory, all you'd have to do is make enough money to pay way big taxes because you can't get a credit against what you're not doing. But if it's a refundable tax credit, once you turn the lights on the first morning, they're going to send you money. That's
well,
how it sounds.
That would be the most ripped off government program in the history of government programs. If
can
true, everyone and their wife and their kids and they would all be starting businesses to get that refundable. That's not going to work. So I don't think it would be that.
No,
that just wouldn't even make sense.
But how can anybody make an intelligent decision, I guess, when you're bombarded from all these sources with people who don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you wonder why the mainstream media is losing credibility.
Really?
Like, you can't even tell us what this is supposed to be. And you haven't even done the work to ask her what she meant by that.
Well, I honestly believe she doesn't know.
I doubt she has put any thought into that policy. Someone just told her to one-up Trump on it.
Did you see among her campaign staff the number of years of independent business experience these people have?
No.
Well, no is about the right word.
Okay.
Most of them, none. The median is none. A couple of them have a couple of years. That's it. So why should we be upset about this? Because she gets wild ovations for saying things like this. The small business tax rate would go to 39.6% from 20. Well, right now what we're doing, people like Adam and me, we operate in the zone called the S-Corp or the LLC, and we're taxed individually for our businesses, and we get a break for that because it encourages small businesses. Like capital gains, and she wants to do the same thing to capital gains, they want to take it all to 39.6%. So if you want to see some small businesses not get started, close, or fail, raise their tax rate to 39.6%.
I can't even tell you how much that would dismay me from wanting to go to work every day.
No. Larger corporations, she wants to raise the tax rate higher than China's.
That, again, makes no sense.
Trump got it down to 21. She wants to go back up to 28. And that puts us right smack dab in the uncompetitive zone around the world when we are trying to bring business back to this country. And I'm reminding everybody, she gets wild ovations from her audiences on this stuff. She wants a tax on unrealized gains, which is anathema to any capitalist.
This is the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
It's unworkable. It'll never pass.
Yeah.
But people love it because it's only on people worth $100 million or more.
That's where it starts.
Yeah. At what they say, any government big enough to give you everything is also big enough to take it all away.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to think about that. A second death tax, because she would disallow the stepped-up basis on assets when someone dies and leave their assets
again,
to their
beneficiaries. This is such a horrible idea, and this one affects everybody.
Everybody.
Now,
I've been on radio for 22 years. And half a dozen times over that time frame, we've received calls from people, and they'd say things like, I just inherited some money, and before I spend any of it, I want to know how much tax I'm going to have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And my standard line is, well, sit down, if you aren't, because I'm going to tell you something that you're probably going to be real surprised about. You won't owe any.
Unless you live in certain states.
There are some rare occasions when that can happen, yes. And I'm going to talk more about that a little later, too. The global minimum tax, remember that? That's Janet Yellen's big baby. They got it passed at 15%, I think. So Ireland, for instance, had an 8% corporate tax, so a lot of companies went to Ireland for tax reasons. Well, then they came in and said, well, even if you operate in Ireland, you're going to have a minimum tax rate of 15%. Oh, wait a minute, isn't Ireland an independent country with independent rules?
Who are you paying? You have to pay Ireland, or do you pay...
I don't know. Absolutely don't know. She wants to quadruple the tax on stock buybacks.
That's so stupid.
Now, stock buybacks happen when a company has outstanding stock and it's worth a lot of money, or maybe not as much money, doesn't matter. But in the current climate for business, they can't find a better investment to spend all their corporate cash than to buy their own stock back. Well, what does that do? For a dividend company, it's wonderful because all the treasury stock, which is what you call that which is unissued and or bought back, they don't pay dividends to themselves. So that pool of dividend money goes to guess who?
The other shareholders.
Yep, the rest of us. How about a 30% federal excise tax on electricity used in cryptocurrency mining?
I mean, that one I don't even care about.
I'm just dumb.
I mean, how do you like say, okay, this electricity went to crypto mining, exactly, and this went to other
like,
activities?
Yeah, it's like those annuity companies where you got your green dollars.
And
you
yeah.
Got
your... So stupid.
Yeah, you can't make this stuff up. Applies the wash sale rules to digital assets.
Again, I don't care, but I think that, I mean, maybe it should apply to that. That one might actually kind of make sense.
Well, how about if I throw this little wrench in your works? According to IRS, digital assets are property.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can't apply it to a property sale.
But what I'm thinking is someone who day trades in Bitcoin or something, like you could, if you didn't know about that and you did apply wash sale rules, you could really get in trouble with that.
By the way, here's a secondary question based on a story I got this week. What's dumber than Bitcoin?
I don't know. Lots of things.
A Bitcoin ATM. Okay. I'm sorry if this is going over some people's heads. I really don't mean to. But would you go to the ATM and deposit money and get Bitcoin back?
I personally, no. But
you can't put it in your hand because it doesn't exist. Wash sale rules mean that you would be not allowed a tax deduction on your property. Never mind. $37 billion increase in energy taxes, 32% increase to Medicare. Next week, I'm doing a lot of Medicare stuff, believe me. $24 billion retirement tax, supersized IRS, even more. Real estate hike on like-kind exchanges for 1031 tax-free exchanges. I'm done. I can't take any more. And this is making her popular. God save the Queen, as Joe Biden would say. We'll be right back with some more goodies. Don't go anywhere. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I remind everybody, lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is still out there. In 2006, we finally got the opportunity to buy gold and silver in the form of exchange-traded funds right there on a stock exchange. If you had put $10,000 into each one that day, you would have quite a bit more money right now, although one has outperformed the other by a bit. I want to know how much more cash today one of them is worth than the other one and which one that might be. All right, a couple of things here. There's a court in Georgia, it's a federal court, that Thursday reiterated what seems to be something of a, just a, what word I'm looking for, something that happens over and over and over, and the administration keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. So this time it was in Georgia where, guess what, forgiving student debt isn't legal.
That's so weird.
Who would have thought of that? How many times the Supreme Court and how many other courts have said no? So this one happened again this week, Thursday, and it was slated to go through as early as this fall. It was another $150 billion of student-held debt that they were forgiving. Now, what in God's green earth makes this so important, unless it's buying votes?
What?
Yeah. No. I honestly can't think of anything else. You've probably heard people talk about the SAVE Act. Well, that's what they're trying to do, but it's not going to save me anything. It's not going to save you anything. It's just ridiculous how they keep hammering at this. And when one is thrown out on constitutional grounds, they go around and seek some other thing to try to do another one. Now, there are still a lot of people who are on pause. There are some of them. There are going to be 8 million more are enrolled now, 8 million total in SAVE. More than half have had their monthly payment set to zero.
Hmm.
Now, what's wrong with that isn't real clear until you realize that they forgive them after 10 years. So how long can you stay at zero and then everything becomes zero?
Yeah, but then you do get hit with a big tax bill once it's forgiven.
Theoretically.
So
remember in the days that you remember better than anybody when people were selling their houses at a substantial loss because they had to move. And that, the what did they call that then? I can't remember.
Yeah, they got rid of the tax on the on.
It was forgiving debt.
Yeah.
Which is a taxable event.
That expired.
Long time.
Yeah, a long time ago. So I think currently you do owe taxes on that. I'm not a tax expert.
Unless somebody passes a tax law and no administration can do that, Congress has to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So right now you might think you're doing yourself a big favor by getting a zero and not doing anything, but you might not be. You know how you get rid of debt?
Pay it off.
Darn. I told you he was good. Yeah, that's it. If you want to pay it off faster, what do?
Pay more.
Man, he's on a roll today, isn't he? That is how it's done, people. It's not holding your hand out. You just go get a job, get a second one if you want to. Seems to be in vogue anyway these days. So that's it. Right, we had a discussion with a listener and friend that I've mentioned a little bit over the last couple of shows, but it was about giving away money. And one of the, this kind of came in right there. Well, essentially, anything that gives you a benefit is taxable income to you. So you know, whether they forgive the debt or whether you take money in. But the gift and estate tax laws are a little bit different. And once you receive it, as Adam said, with some rare exceptions, you're going to receive that gift or you're going to receive that inheritance tax-free, which is good. So had a friend who wanted to give $100,000 to each of two kids that were not his own relatives, and he was hoping to find the best way possible for him. You know, if somebody's going to get a benefit somewhere besides the kid, of course it would be the person who's the giver. Unfortunately, under tax rules, and when I was young and just learning about this, I thought, this is crazy. My attorney at the time told me that in gifting and estate rules, the only taxes are paid by the giver. So it can be the estate that pays the taxes, or it can be the person who gives money pays the taxes, if there's any to give, but never the recipient. And I thought, well, that's strange, but having been in this business now for a long time after that, I'm starting to see the wisdom of how this whole thing shakes out. So you know, given the fact that there's going to be some taxes here and there, what do you do? So we got talking about some possibilities. One of them, a lot of people know about this, and I'm sure a lot of people don't know about this, but any real person can give any other real person. What that means is a living, breathing human being, and not a trust or anything like that. It doesn't depend on relationships. It doesn't depend on anything. Any person can give any other person a certain amount of money every year, tax-free, don't even have to report it. That current number is $18,000 a year, and it might go up again. It's indexed to inflation in large chunks of $1,000 when the numbers show that would keep it even. And I can argue the effectiveness of that or not, so I won't. Anyway, you can give anybody $18,000. So one of the things we talked about, well, you can do $18,000 each this year. So now they get another 82. You get 18,000 on the 2nd of January. Then it goes down again. And every January thereafter, you can give them that amount, and chances are it'll go up to 19 one day. And only when it's all paid off does that wind up your obligation, which only you set the obligation, by the way, not your recipient. But that is a very plausible way to do it, and it was all dependent on a question that I asked. I said, well, what's their relationship been with money? And the answer was kind of funny. Said, no one knows. I've never had any.
Yeah, that's not an uncommon answer.
It's not at all uncommon. And I had to chuckle a little bit. So when you're thinking about this, think about that. Who is the recipient going to be? Now, if you want to pay some money, and have a larger degree of control, you can use a trust. And the trust will have to be drafted by an attorney. It'll cost you money. But you can use a lot of control in a trust by serving as the trustee. So they'd basically apply to you as the trustee whenever they needed a draw. And you would determine whether or not that's a good idea. And until the money's gone, you're maintaining a very high level of control there. That's good. Now, if they're young, and of course, young people, you don't want people under 18 getting this. You can set up certain types of accounts that would go into, but then they fully vest upon reaching age 18, and you might not want to do that either. Or you could set up a 529 college savings plan, but in this case, the recipients were over college age, and that did not work. But the general theme here is when it comes to giving, if you don't know the rules, be very careful and consult somebody who does, or you can make a big mistake and something unintended might happen. Now, when you do give money in excess of $18,000, you have to file a tax form, a gift tax form. It will only cost you the preparation fee of the form. It doesn't cost anything else, because each individual in America has the ability right now to give away during his or her lifetime around $13.5 million. So most people, that's unaffected, of course. That might be cut down somewhat if the tax cuts expire, but it's still going to wind up $6, $7 million. Most people don't have to worry about that. But if you're going to give away more than the annual freebie, so to speak, then make sure you file a gift tax return. There was an old joke that we used to tell back in the 80s. Our CPA and attorney would get together and say, well, the story goes that in the halls of the IRS, they'd open an envelope and the guy would pull out a tax form and stand up in the middle of the room and say, hey, look, everybody, some idiot filed a gift tax return.
Yeah.
Do it. Trust me, do it. There are many better ways to find things now. I mean, even if the kid, you know, give the kid $50,000 or $100,000 or something, kid goes to buy a house, they want to know where that money came from.
Mm-hmm.
And they can track it. And if you were the source of the money, then you hopefully have filed a gift tax return on that. And it will just accumulate until you're gone anyway. So it's not a big deal. You just do it. Let's see. What other little goodies do we have today? Price controls don't curb inflation. You notice how fast the price control chatter died down?
It's weird that it's almost like stupid ideas get pushed away. I don't know.
When your own acolytes do it, then you know you've done something really bad. So that one went
away. Again, it just goes back to like, if you ask a third grader, well, how do you stop a company from prices from going up? Well, tell the government to put a cap on all the prices.
Exactly.
I mean, that's
and then what happens? So I wanted to refer everyone to a book. It's called The War on Prices by Ryan Born of the Cato Institute. And he goes through the history of all the failures of price controls. And there are a lot of them. I personally have lived through a few. If you're in my age group and lived through Richard Nixon, you know the folly of these things.
So what was the trivia answer? We're almost out of here.
The trivia answer, gold has outperformed silver. Gold's worth about 35 and change now, 1,000, where silver's only about 18.5, so it's around a $17,000 difference.
So it hasn't even doubled in 20 years. That's not great performance.
That's why they don't call gold and silver investments. They call them storehouse of value and things like that. So a lesson learned on a Saturday morning. Lots more next week, a lot of Medicare. We'll see you then.